Hello, this is Science Weekly. I'm Alok Jha. On this week's podcast, we're on an end-of-term science trip to the Royal Institution in London. Chris Bishop will be telling us about his quest for the ultimate computer. Plus, the Science Museum steps into the debate on GM foods.
I actually think the American technology might run into the sands because it's so focused upon monocropping, so tacked into and locked into oil-guzzling American intensive agriculture, that actually GM in America is probably not going to survive as long as its adherents think.
This is a News Jam free Science Weekly from The Guardian. Hello and welcome to the Royal Institution in the heart of London's Mayfair. Let me paint a picture for you of where we are. We're in the Faraday Lecture Theatre here, the home of almost 180 years of Christmas lectures. Joining me is Guardian Science correspondent James Randerson.
Thanks very much for letting me out of the office.
It's a much nicer place, isn't it?
It is.
Now, before we meet our guest, you may not know much about the RI, so here's a little info. It's an independent charity designed to connect people with science. It's a museum, but also does research and has been doing it for 200 years. More info in our podcast back in July on the RI. The Christmas lectures for children are probably its most famous activity. This year, a series of five are being broadcast in the UK between 29th of December and 2nd of January. The theme this year is Making the Ultimate Computer. Professor Chris Bishop is going to present these. He's Chief Research Scientist at Microsoft, and he joins us today. Thanks for joining us, Chris.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to join your podcast.
Now, everyone thinks they know what a computer is. Let's get the voice of an expert. What is a computer?
It's really a very general concept. It's something that processes information. It certainly includes your laptop and your mobile phone, but it could include things like DNA as well. It's a very broad concept.
And there's a remarkable statistic in one of your lectures, which is that there are more computers than there are people in the world.
That's right. There are actually more computers made each year than there are people in the world. But many of these computers are not the laptops and desktops that we normally think of. So every year about 100 million new microprocessors are made that go into laptop and desktop, traditional computers if you like. But there are 100 times as many processors that are made for what we call ubiquitous computing or pervasive computing or embedded computers. These are computers that are embedded into all sorts of everyday objects. I mean, the common example is the mobile phone. That's the one we're very familiar with, but they appear in toys, in thermostats. There are probably 30 in your car if you've got a sort of mid-price family car. Computers are absolutely everywhere, and often we don't even realize it.
And this is all due to miniaturization. It's due to the fact that we've engineered microprocessors to such staggering degrees. I mean, again, the numbers here are the most incredible things. I mean, how many switches, microprocessors and things are there in a typical sort of computer?
Well, that's right. It's all made possible because of the microprocessor, and it's an extraordinary piece of technology. If you buy a computer today, there are probably 400 million switches or transistors on a tiny silicon chip the size of your fingernail, and that number has been doubling every couple of years or so. So within a year or two, there'll be several billion transistors on each tiny silicon chip.
Take us through a journey of where we've come from. Where did these things start? Who came up with them? And how far have we come in that time?
Well, I suppose how far do you want to take it back? I mean, one of the fascinating pieces of history that I discovered in preparing the lectures is the fact that the first semiconductor, so I should explain that silicon is an example of a material called semiconductors, and it's semiconductors that's really allowed this revolution to happen. And the very first semiconductor was discovered here in the Royal Institution back in 1833 by Michael Faraday, so you could say it has its origins in this very building, which is quite remarkable. It is, absolutely. You go back to 1947 was the invention of the transistor. So that's just a tiny, very fast electronic switch with no moving parts. And then in the sort of 50s, people began to put several transistors down on one piece of silicon, four transistors, then 10, then 20. And somebody called Gordon Moore noticed that the number of transistors seemed to be doubling every 2 years. It became known as Moore's Law, and it's held ever since. It's held for the last 40 years. So you have this extraordinary phenomenon where the number of components doubles every 2 years, and along with it, the speed of processors has been doubling every 2 years. And there's no other technology in the world that's advanced in that extraordinary way.
Moore's Law is about to hit a hot brick wall, isn't it?
Well, that's right. That was the theme of Lecture 1. Lecture 1 is called Breaking the Speed Limit. It's about the fact that we've had this breathtaking growth in the speed of processors. but we've hit a limit just in the last year or two, and the limit turns out to be heat. Essentially what happens is as you make the components smaller, they can switch on and off faster, and so the processors increase in performance, but also every time they switch on and off, they produce a little bit of heat. And because there are more and more of them in a tinier and tinier space, the heat density has been going up and up and up. And right now on a modern chip, it's about the same as a hot plate on a cooking hob. And if we carried on doubling the speed every 2 years, then in 10 years' time, the heat density would be the same as at the surface of the sun, which obviously is going to cause some problems.
You don't want that on your laptop, do you?
Well,
get around this, do you think?
Well, in the short term, what we're doing is we're putting multiple little processing engines on the same piece of silicon. So making use of the fact that there are more and more transistors for the designers to play with. And sort of, instead of having the chip do, as it were, one thing at a time, but very, very quickly, it has two separate little processing engines called cores, and they're each working at the same time. And that trend will continue. So in a few years, we'll have 4 cores and 8 cores and 16 cores. But each of them will be running at the same speed. It's rather that they'll be sharing the workload. So instead of having, you know, instead of having one person building a house, you've now got 4, 8, 16, 32. And if you can share the workload effectively amongst those processors, then the speed will double in a sort of commensurate way. So it looks as if for the next 10 or 15 years at least, we'll continue to see processors double in speed.
But this is going to create another problem, isn't it? Because these cores are going to need some quite clever ways of talking to each other so you don't lose power and speed that way.
That's exactly right. If you've got a 64 cores, then in principle it could run 64 times as fast. But it's like any other task sharing problem. Having 64 people doesn't necessarily make the thing run 64 times faster. Things can even slow down when you add more people, as we know from practice. And the same thing can happen with these cores. Unless they can share data and talk to each other efficiently, we won't necessarily get the full benefit of having all those cores. So that's a big challenge for computer science right now.
So it's all down to communication, as everything. It's all down to communication between people or cores or whatever. Now, one other thing that's obviously changed about computers in the last 40, 50 years is the way we interact with them. So in the past, the machine was the size of a room. You might have punch cards, all sorts of things, or specifically trained operators. Now we're all used to typing things, emails and things off keyboards. Going back to that statistic from the beginning, where there's more computers than there are people, how have people learnt new ways to interact with these sorts of things? Because otherwise we'd have keyboards everywhere if every one of these required a QWERTY thing to sort of control them.
Exactly. So the goal really here is to allow people to have the benefits of computing without even realizing they're using computers. A good example is the family car I mentioned earlier. Typical family car probably has about 30 computers in it. They're all connected together by a little local network, like a mini internet inside your car. And they're doing all sorts of things, controlling the door locks, the windscreen wipers, and so on. So when you apply the brake pedals, you're not directly applying the brakes. What you're doing is you're sending a signal to a computer. The computer looks at the rotation speeds of each of the four wheels. It looks at the angle of the steering wheel, which tells the computer which direction the driver wants to go in. It looks at a gyroscope to see which direction the car is actually going in. If they're different, that could indicate a skid. And then it makes a decision 20 times a second on how much force to apply to each of the four wheels separately to achieve braking. And all that's going on without your even thinking about the fact you're using a computer. And so that's really the goal. And those are very small computers. In terms of sort of bigger, more powerful computers, there's a lot of interest, a lot of research now in new ways of displaying information and interacting with them, again, without using keyboards. So in Lecture 2, Chips with Everything, we have some lovely examples of new display technologies. We have a beautiful three-dimensional display. It's the only one of its kind in Europe, which actually creates a three-dimensional image. It's a medical scan, as the example we show, the inside of a human chest, showing the spine and the lungs, and you can see the diaphragm going up and down as the person is breathing. It's all transparent. You can see the organs, and as you walk around it, you can see it from different perspectives. It's extraordinary technology.
And can you interact with something like that?
This particular one is a display only. We have another display, a spherical display, where you can show things like a globe, for example, or we also show a 360-degree panoramic video feed, which we take from just outside the lecture theatre. And that is what we call a multi-touch display. So it's sensitive to touch, but you can touch it in multiple places at the same time and spin the globe round, get hold of images, resize them, and all sorts of things. That's a fully interactive display.
I mean, people might be familiar with this idea of touching displays to control computers. If anyone's got an iPhone, they already do this to some extent. Right. Is this the future then for the way that we're going to interact with our own PCs at home?
Yes, the iPhone is a good example of a multi-touch display, and we have a much larger example in Lecture 2, a sort of table that's with the surface of the table is also multi-touch. And in some situations, that's a very natural way to interact. In other situations, it's not. So sometimes you don't want to walk up and touch a display. You want to interact with it from a distance. So if it's your television, you might be sitting on the sofa. You might just want to gesture at the television and have it control something, for example. So I think we'll see lots of different ways of interacting. We won't see one particular way.
I'm interested, you know, what was it like to deliver the lectures when you sort of first walked into this room?
Well, it's an incredible privilege. I mean, as a child, I watched the Christmas lectures every year, was absolutely fascinated by them. And it was the Christmas lectures were certainly a factor in my decision to become a scientist. There's no question about that. But I never had the good fortune actually to come to the lectures. I only ever saw them on television. And it was only about a year ago that I came to the Royal Institution for the first time. And I remember walking into this this incredibly famous Faraday Lecture Theatre, where Faraday himself lectured, you know, nearly two centuries ago. And the first thing that struck me is how small it is, because, of course, on television it looks huge, and you come in and it looks tiny. And then somebody says, well, actually it holds 400 people. And it's sort of hard to believe. It's the lecture theatre sort of wraps around us. It's a bit like a sort of Roman amphitheatre, very steeply raked, with and you stand in the middle, and you have people on both sides and in front of you wrapped around. And it feels very intimate. You feel very close. Even people in the back row seem very close. And the lecture theatre feels very small, even though it holds 400 people.
There's very little leg room. That's my experience. it's okay for kids, I suppose. But
I think everybody gets a good view because it's so steeply raked.
That's very true. And, I mean, from those early experiences of watching them, were there particular kind of demonstrations that really brought concepts alive for you? Or
When I was a teenager, I was very interested in chemistry. And I thought I sort of understood chemistry. You know, chemistry, you mix A and B and something happens. You get an explosion or a colour change or whatever. And C and D are produced as the sort of end product.
Your mum was keen on you doing that in your bedroom.
My parents were very supportive, actually. But yes, we used to have some fun. But I watched the Christmas lectures one year. It was probably George Porter, I suspect. He was a chemist. He was the director of the Royal Institution. And he showed an experiment where he mixed some liquids together, and they were being stirred, and they started off red and they turned to blue, nothing very unusual. And then after a moment or two, it turned back to red again, and then it went back and it turned blue again. And it was sort of oscillating, and it was a complete shock. And I thought, chemistry doesn't do that. It was extraordinary. So it sort of revealed a much more complex kind of chemistry than the kind that I was sort of experimenting with in my bedroom.
Some slightly confused molecules, were they?
Well, they were very clever molecules. They were well, they were almost doing a primitive form of computation, and people have even looked at chemistry as a way of doing computing, but obviously very complex chemistry.
Well, let's talk about that, the way that computing is evolving. One of the ideas in the future is going to be that computers are going to have to be much more intelligent, and I mean intelligent in the way that we're intelligent, by recognizing things around us, knowing that something is a cat as opposed to a dog, that kind of thing. And in all science fiction, computers can do all these things. Now, but it's actually a fascinatingly complicated thing to get computers to do. They can do calculations very quickly, lots of them. But tell us what the problems are that you're facing now in cutting-edge computing. How are you going to get to this intelligence problem?
Right. Well, it's a major goal, of course, of computer science, and has been for a long time. And it's the subject of the fifth of the Christmas lectures, called Digital Intelligence. And it really looks at the fact that the things that computers are good at and the things that people are good at are sort of opposites. They're complementary, if you like. Computers are incredibly good at multiplying numbers together. Most people, certainly, I'm very bad at multiplying numbers. I make lots of mistakes. It takes a long time. Whereas people are very good at doing things like recognizing objects or having conversations or composing music and so on. Computers are very bad at this. So that's one of the big frontiers of computer science at the moment.
So can you give us some examples of from the lectures of how computing is moving forward to try and tackle this goal?
Well, the key idea really now is that because it proves to be so difficult to program a computer to do any of these things that we consider to be intelligent, we now adopt a completely different approach. We do something very different. We program the computer to learn from experience, and then we train the computer to solve a problem. So the example I give in the lectures is telling cats from dogs, or just recognizing everyday objects. So instead of trying to program the computer with rules about what a cat looks like, what a dog looks like, that turns out it doesn't work. The world's far too complex to be described by simple rules. So instead, we program the computer so that it becomes adaptive, so that it can learn. And then we just show it 10,000 images and say, well, these 5,000 are cats, these 5,000 are dogs. Now, you go figure out statistically what it is that distinguishes cats from dogs, and that works much better.
I mean, it's a bit of a brute force way of doing it, but is that the way you think that all of this will be done in the future?
You can think of it as brute force. It's really exploiting the huge computational capacity of computers. But if you look at the speed of modern computers, it's still well short of the effective processing capacity of the brain. So something like a third of the human brain is devoted to visual processing. And if you estimate it's hard to do because you're comparing chalk with cheese, but if you try to estimate the processing capabilities of the brain, it's huge, far, far greater than present-day supercomputers. And it would be surprising if we could achieve the same capabilities of the brain using far less computing. So it's going to be brute force in the sense I expect us to have to use a huge amount of computing power in order to do these kinds of tasks.
The brain manages it without heating up to the
sun. It does. The brain is very efficient in its use of energy. And the brain also, of course, is three-dimensional. I mean, modern computer chips are sort of two-dimensional. They might have 10 or 20 layers, but they're still built on the surface of a flat sheet, whereas the brain is wired up in three dimensions. We haven't really learned how to build three-dimensional systems yet.
In the recordings of the lectures, you've had, what was it, you said 100 demonstrations or something?
Something like
practical
that,
demonstrations.
Yes.
Did any of them go wrong?
We had certainly had plenty of glitches in the rehearsals. We had over 100 demonstrations on our list, many of them very complex, many of them involving quite sophisticated or very new technologies. And I think we only had one complete failure of a demonstration actually during a lecture, and it happened just a few minutes into the lecture. And we simply went back and did it again, and the second time it worked perfectly.
So viewers aren't going to see the
we won't show them the first version. We'll show them the version where it worked.
You didn't have to sort of switch it off and on again or something like that.
we just had to come. It was one of those demonstrations that was very that made use of infrared light. It worked in a normal lighting environment, but in what effectively had become a television studio with these very hot spotlights producing a lot of infrared radiation, it caused the detectors to get confused. But for some reason, the second time it worked perfectly.
No explaining that. Chris, thank you very much. We'll come back to you at the end of the show. The Five Christmas Lectures are broadcast on Channel 5 starting December the 29th. For more information, go to rigb.org.
Science Weekly from guardian.co.uk with Alok Jha.
Next, where do you stand in the GM debate? An exhibition has just opened at the London Science Museum asking just that. It's called Future Foods and examines the global food crisis as well as the effect of climate change. Producer Andy went along and spoke to the man who opened it, Tim Lang. He's Professor of Food Technology at London City University. He asked whether the handling of the GM issue has left Britain lagging behind the rest of the world.
I think it's actually brought the UK into a more mature position. I am a food democrat, not a food controller. I think history shows that ultimately it is people who will decide because they eat. And what we had was, and why I use the word cack-handed, what we had was a classic illustration of a top-down injection of a technology. Here, by the way, here's something we've done, wham, bang, here it is. And then the companies went bonkers when there was, well, why do we need this? Why? What are the implications? What does it do to me? Etc. Perfectly legitimate questions. What we're now in the position, 10, 15 years on, is to be able to say, well, could it be useful for sustainable agriculture? I don't think it'll offer anything to deal with the nutrition problems or urbanisation. I don't think it's got anything to answer critical issues for world food policy like that. But maybe it's got an opportunity to help us speed up the adaptation to some issues associated with climate change. Who knows? I think we should debate it. I don't think we should say it's either Frankenstein or it's the answer to everything, you know, the best thing since sliced bread, as we say. I don't think anything can be pocketed and pigeonholed as crudely as that. The good thing about Britain and Europe is actually we've had a fast learning curve about food in the last 20 years. It's fabulous. We're the most literate food culture now. We're very sophisticated in our understandings of risk, of difficulties, of control, of what we want. We know these complex issues. On the one hand, massive obesity, out of control overweight, alongside massive malnutrition and rising problems of diet-related disease. We can understand all of that. Now let the debate happen again.
we're having this debate here in the UK now. Is it a waste of time since it's already been introduced in the States, which is producing food on a massive scale?
At one level, the horse has bolted. There's no doubt about that. But that taught people like me, or reminded people like me, of a very old lesson in food policy. Whereas when a technology has been developed, if some people say no to it, it'll be dumped on those who have least capacity to resist. There was a great deal of concern about the technology being foisted on developing countries. And the good thing that happened was there's a real north-south developed world, developing world exchange about the issues. And I think in the developing world, there's equally a very mature debate going on. I don't think the issue is these big Americans have done it, therefore it's inevitable. I actually think the American technology might run into the sands because it's so focused upon monocropping, so tacked into and locked into big, intensive, oil-guzzling American intensive agriculture, that actually GM in America is probably not going to survive as long as its adherents think. I think even in the US, a sustainable development debate is going to happen over GM. It's already happening, actually, not least due to the genetic pollution issue.
There's more from Tim, as well as from Dr. Emile Frisson, Director of Biodiversity International, in the latest Science Weekly Extra podcast. Go to guardian.co.uk/scienceweekly. And there'll be a debate on these issues at the Science Museum's Dana Centre on 22nd of January, which will also be webcast across the world.
Science Weekly.
Some feedback now from the blog on last week's podcast. If you remember, it was an Enigma machine and the code-breaking challenge. It seems to have flummoxed quite a few of you. But first, a couple of comments on the new generation of Formula One racing game that uses GPS technology that we mentioned, meaning you could drive against Lewis Hamilton in real time.
Keith Tallant says, "The virtual racing idea is an impressive technical feat, but it's likely to prove rather dull after the novelty wears off. Few players could stomach a full-length F1 race, and how will pit stops be handled?"
According to I'm Hot EPA from Germany, a TV magazine there compared the skills of video gamers and real-world gamers. For example, someone who was very good as a video tightrope walker was a flop on the real tightrope.
And on the cipher puzzle,
Kilduck thinks there was relatively little hope of solving the code. He tried reversing the letters, groups reversed, every possible shift.
"I'm glad it wasn't just me," says Mark D314. "As soon as they mentioned the clue, I paused it and tried out all the Caesar shift possibilities with no joy. The only way I could think of working it out is if they'd included other characters such as spacers along with the basic 26 letters, but I wasn't anal enough to test that."
Mark D314, you should have been anal perhaps, because I think that was actually quite key to the fact that the code works.
Then Toastmeister popped up to save the day. "Try reversing the shifted alphabet."
Then IFOX said, "Thanks for that tip, solved it now." And then suggests cryptography doesn't really lend itself to the podcast medium.
Which is a fair point. It sounds like a whole soap opera, all of that. Now have your say on this podcast. Either join our Facebook group and post a comment on the wall, or leave us a text present on the blog at guardian.co.uk/scienceweekly. And if you're missing all of these science news jam stuff, go to guardian.co.uk/science. Back now to our guest, Chris Bishop from Microsoft. Chris, we were just talking about cryptography there. Last week we had John Alexander, who's collects cipher machines and brought in various cipher machines from the Second World War, the Enigma and everything. They were beautiful things. And Simon Singh was talking about cryptography on the internet, and it's a big issue. Cryptography is also one of the subjects of your lectures.
That's right. So the fourth lecture is called Untangling the Web. And we look at a little bit about how cryptography is done on the web. We look at one-time pads and the XOR way of scrambling a message with a key and unscrambling it. Perhaps the most interesting thing we look at is the problem of key exchange. So, you know, going back to things like the Enigma and so on, they had key books and they had to be distributed as physical keys, physical key books that had to be sent out to forces in the field and so on. And this would never have worked on the internet. If you go to buy something off the internet, your computer has to establish a secure link to a computer halfway around the world that it's never had any communication with before. They have to share a secret key. It's important that nobody else has that key. And the problem is, how's that going to come about? And it's one of the most extraordinary discoveries, I think, in computer science about 30 years ago or so, that people like Diffie and Hellman and others discovered how to do this key exchange. And I sometimes say it's a bit like this. Imagine two strangers meet in a pub. They've never communicated with each other before. And they've each got to think of a secret number. One of them's going to think of the number 42, and the other one has to be thinking of 42 as well. But nobody else must know what that number is, even though everybody's listening to their discussions. And for a long time, it was thought that was an impossible thing to do, but it was discovered that it can be done, and we managed to come up with a lovely demonstration for the lectures explaining exactly how this happens by mixing coloured water. We have water with food colouring in, and we show by mixing these different colours together, two people can agree on a secret colour, and if you think of colours representing numbers, then that's how the key exchange works.
And essentially, this is how the internet is enabled, because allowing this sort of encryption allows people to communicate securely through emails or through e-commerce and so on. The internet itself has changed computers in other ways. More and more things are becoming networked. You can control them from lots of places. They're feeding information through. What's going to happen to the next few generations of the web, for example?
Well, there are many different directions that it could evolve in, but if you think of the web initially as a kind of big library, you go to a search engine and you type in some words and it gives you a list of places to go and read about stuff. And that's incredibly powerful. That's been revolutionary. But of course, in one sense, it's very primitive. What you'd really like to be able to do is to ask a question, for example, and ask a question in normal English and have your computer go away and do all the research for you. Go away and find the relevant websites, read them, understand them in some sense, and compile an answer and come back to you. And that's something which can be done at the moment, but it's I'd say at a fairly primitive state. But that's an example of a direction that you might like the web to go in.
And that requires, of course, computers to understand text or have labelling on them which tells it where what things mean.
That's right. I think there's a sense in which people understand the meaning of what they're reading in a way that computers don't. So what computers do is they use statistical processing to do things like answer questions. I'm constantly surprised at just how far we can get with just crunching statistics, but nevertheless, of course, it will always be well short of what a human can do when the human actually understands what it is they're reading.
This notion of the semantic web, which, you know, will allow you to actually ask your computer a question rather than the sort of more basic way we search at the moment, I think it could have really profound impact in that it'll almost kind of change the way we think about, you know, what makes someone clever and what constitutes kind of scholarship and study. Because, I mean, at the moment, if you're at university, you know, academics are always saying, oh, you know, youngsters these days, they're not prepared to go away and do the donkey work of reading all the sources and you know, kind of digesting all that information and learning from it. And, you know, in the future, we just won't need to do that.
It's an interesting thought. I think the technology does change our view of what constitutes creativity and intelligence and so on. Back in the 1970s, artificial intelligence researchers used to consider the problem of playing chess as being a sort of one of the pinnacles of human intellectual accomplishment. If we could build a machine that played chess, my goodness, everything else would be easy. Now, of course, we have chess-playing computers that can beat virtually any human. But, of course, all they're doing is using brute force again. They're just looking at millions of board positions a second. And because we know that they're doing this brute force thing, we don't consider that to be intelligent. We just consider that to be fast. And so we no longer think of chess as being an intelligent activity for a computer, at least. And in fact, there's a joke in the world of artificial intelligence that artificial intelligence is anything that a computer can't yet do. And right. And I think the same thing will happen on the web. As we have technologies that can do things that presently can only be done by humans, then we'll come to accept those as automated tasks. But the truly creative things, I think, things will not be automated for the foreseeable future.
But Chris, do you think that there's going to be new types of creativity that humans are going to develop because of this technology? For example, if you think about the way that we've interacted with computers since they came along, at first, to work with a computer, we work with punch cards, that kind of thing, took about 90% of your time just making sure there's no errors in those punch cards. And you moved very, very slowly in actually programming things. When software came along, the actual fun for computer scientists became programming, and we moved through generational leaps of software and the creativity was expressed in a completely different way. Just because the computer made something easier doesn't mean that the creativity for people disappeared. So for the semantic web, if I can just ask, what does this mean? It allows me to then more quickly get to another problem that I'm thinking about. I mean,
absolutely.
Does it won't take away necessarily from what it means to be clever about something.
Not at all. I think quite the reverse. So people always worry that the next generation of technology will take away the interesting stuff. But usually, because computers are good at the sort of the drudgery, usually it takes away the drudgery and enhances creativity. I mean, the web has certainly done that. I think people, you know, in your own field in journalism, you have access now to much more information. It doesn't mean that journalism is dead. It may mean you have access to much more information, and therefore much more need for the human creative element to filter and digest and combine this and understand it, interpret it.
It's interesting. This is a kind of echo of a thought that my grandmother used to repeat years ago, which she was very sceptical of computers because, I mean, this must have gone back to kind of, I don't know, like the 50s or something like that, when the idea was that these computers come along and take people's jobs away. And it's kind of, you know, you can imagine people thinking in a kind of Luddite way, or, you know, this is going to take away human creativity or something. But as you say, it kind of shifts, allows us to do so much more, and then shifts the really clever stuff to something else.
Exactly. You could say it's a happy fact of the world of computing that, as I said earlier, computers and humans are sort of opposite ends of a spectrum, and what computers are good at, people are bad at, and vice versa. And I can't foresee a day when computers will take away the creative aspects of human intelligence. And to me, that's the most fun part anyway.
Chris, before we wind up, I have to ask you about something which I read in your biography. Now, you are a physicist by training, and you worked with one of our heroes, Peter Higgs. What was he like?
Peter was wonderful. He was a sort of co-supervisor. David Wallace at Edinburgh was my main supervisor, who was absolutely fantastic as a supervisor, and I had a little bit of support as well from Peter. And it was fascinating to be around Peter. He's a very, very quiet, very modest, very unassuming, obviously incredibly intelligent man, and who's had a tremendously profound impact on our understanding of the world. His mechanism of spontaneous symmetry breaking, which explains why particles have mass, is very simple and very elegant. Very beautiful, I think.
Not sure how simple it is.
have you sort of had any contact with him over the last year? Because, of course, you know, with the Large Hadron Collider starting up and all the excitement about, you know, will they or won't they find the Higgs boson and all the rest of it, you know, how is he dealt with that?
Well, I'm very fortunate because I have a joint appointment between Microsoft Research and Edinburgh University, and I spend time at Edinburgh, and so I see him from time to time. I don't think he's somebody who seeks publicity. I think he would love to see the theory confirmed, or at least investigated one way or the other. I think he'd love to understand the answer to this puzzle of the mass of particles. But I don't think he's somebody who actively seeks a lot of publicity.
Well, Chris, thank you so much for your time today. More information about the Christmas lectures are available at rigb.org, and they'll be on Channel 5, of course, from December the 29th, and also available to download from the Channel 5's website and the RIGB website after that. If you're interested in how the lectures were made, Guardian Video sent some cameras around during the filming, and you'll be able to see a behind-the-scenes exclusive on December the 29th, also at guardian.co.uk/video. Thanks to James Randerson and to the Royal Institution for letting us take over. Next Monday, we'll look back at 2008 through the eyes of Science Weekly. We'll be looking at some of the highlights and possibly some of the big stories of the year, if we have time. Don't forget to add your voice to the debate at guardian.co.uk/scienceweekly. This podcast was produced by Andy Duckworth. I'm Alok Jha. Thanks for listening, and happy Christmas. Other faiths are available.